What is good, everyone? We're still on season four, but we're now on episode nine. So appreciate you all listening into this awesome content. And in the near future, might be doing videos. That way, those of you that are tired of just hearing audio and want some kind of visual, I will do my best to get that for you. But for now, we're going to cover our list. Our list is going to be on the letter D, as well as probably E. But for now, we'll stick to letter D, and we'll see if we're going to move past that. But while the first one on the list that I mentioned is dousing, first one on the list here that I have from sources Da'at. It's D-A apostrophe A-T. It's one of the points of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. It's a sephirot in Kabbalah. And I believe that in the near future it'll be best, so that way y'all are able to see the pictures instead of just me defining it by word. I mean, I can, but sometimes visuals a bit better on that. However, that being said, Da'at is one of the 11 sephirot. You have Keter, Bina, Chokhmah, Da'at, Gevurah, Hesed, Tifereh, Hod, Netzah, Yed, Yesod, Malkuth. So, anyone ascending into the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, I highly recommend you stop. It has nothing to do with the actual Tree of Life. It has everything to do with the enemy's kingdom. Everything to do with the enemy's kingdom. There's no life in it. It is all spiritual death. It is not a good thing to get involved with. As I have mentioned previously, I am not going to cover the depths of Kabbalah here. The best source I've found so far is by Dan Duvall on Exposing Kabbalah. This is a series, it's a 12-part series, or 13-part, whatever. But they're about an hour each, to about an hour and a half, some of them. But it's a good series to go through that has a lot of information that exposes all that stuff. So, put it this way, Kabbalah is heavily influencing the church today. Minus the other stuff that we've talked about, okay? But this is one of the key things in Western Christianity that is influencing the church heavily. Mainly North America. Mainly. Not to say that other countries aren't involving themselves in it. They are involving themselves in it, most unknowingly, some knowingly. But Kabbalah is Jewish mysticism, nothing to get yourself involved with. But the next one that they have on the list, which I won't really call an occult term or power, but they call it as deal with the devil. They say here is a cultural motif exemplified by the legend of Faust and the figure of Mephistopheles, as well as being elemental to many Christian traditions. According to traditional Christian belief about witchcraft, the pact is between a person and the devil, or another demon, trading a soul for diabolical favors, which vary by the tale, but lend to include youth, knowledge, wealth, fame, and power. It was also believed that some people made this type of pact just as a sign of recognizing the minion as their master and exchanging for nothing. The bargain is a dangerous one, as the price of the fiend's service is a wagerer's soul. For most religions, the tale may have a bad end, with eternal damnation for the foolhardy venturer. Conversely, it may have a comic twist, in which a wily peasant outwits the devil, characteristically, on a technical point. The individual making the pact sometimes tries to outwit the devil, but loses in the end. E.g., man sells his soul for eternal life because he will never die to pay his end of the bargain. Immune to the death penalty, he commits murder, but is sentenced to life in prison. There was a Twilight Zone episode about that. Some guy didn't technically murder his wife. She fell out the window because she was backing up. He didn't push her out, but he said, "Oh yeah, I killed my wife," and so then they sentenced him to life in prison. Like that. Number of famous works refer to pacts with the devil, from the numerous European devil's bridges to the violin virtuosity of Giuseppe Tartini and Niccolo Paganini to the crossroad myth associated with Robert Johnson. In Stiff Thompson's Motive Index of Folk Literature, Bargain with the Devil constitutes motif number M210 and Man Sells Soul to Devil, motif number M211. Now, do these things happen? Absolutely, without a doubt. But that doesn't mean the enemy, it doesn't mean the devil owns the soul. Only God owns the souls. That doesn't mean that the enemy can't use that soul for evil purposes. Absolutely. It just means that they're able to use that soul and extend its essence in certain ways, in certain areas, in certain things, and throughout history. So the enemy is not going to own the soul, but they will be able to use the soul because they created a binding contract. Now, the action they have on the list is called Deja Vu. If you've not heard of Deja Vu, you must be living under a rock. But it's French for already seen. It's a French loanword for the phenomenon of feeling as though one has lived through the present situation before. It's an illusion of memory whereby, despite a strong sense of recollection, the time, place, and context of the previous experience are uncertain or impossible. Approximately 2/3 of surveyed populations report experiencing déjà vu at least one time in their lives. The phenomenon manifests occasionally as a symptom of seizure auras, and some researchers have associated chronic frequent pathological déjà vu with neurological or psychiatric illness. Experiencing déjà vu has been correlated with higher socioeconomic status, better educational attainment, and lower ages. Socioeconomic status, abbreviated SES, is an economic and sociological combined total measure of a individual's work experience and of an individual's or family's economic access to resources and social position in relation to others. So they're talking about the wealthy, which I wouldn't be surprised, being some of them are pedophiles and don't want to have that in their forefront of their minds. But people who travel often, frequently watch films, or frequently remember their dreams are also more likely to experience deja vu than others. There is some more that talks about, like, the etymology, medical disorders. I'll go over that. Deja vu is associated with temporal lobe epilepsy. This experience is a neurological anomaly related to epileptic electrical discharge in the brain, creating a strong sensation that an event or experience currently being experienced has already been experienced in the past. Migraines with aura are also associated with deja vu. Early researchers tried to establish a link between deja vu and mental disorders such as anxiety, dissociative identity disorder, and schizophrenia, but failed to find correlations of any diagnostic value. Well, you know, I don't know what researcher is going to be able to find a correlation, because they're not specified in helping the individual on a spiritual level. So, but no special association has been found between deja vu and schizophrenia. A 2008 study found that deja vu experiences are unlikely to be pathological dissociative experiences. Some research has looked into genetics when considering deja vu. Although there is not currently a gene associated with deja vu, the LGI1 type of gene, LGI1 gene on chromosome 10, is being studied for a possible link. Certain forms of the gene are associated with a mild form of epilepsy, and though by no means a certainty, deja vu along with jamai vu occurs often enough during seizures, such as simple partial seizures. Our researchers have reason to suspect a link. Jamai vu is a French loanword meaning never seen. They also have pharmacology. There's also explanations such as split perception explanation, memory-based explanation. Excuse me. This would be going into implicit memory. And cryptomnesia, as well as dual neurological processing, a dream-based explanation as well. And they also have related terms in here as well. But essentially, deja vu would be where someone went through something and that it was suppressed from their mind, and that suppressed memory that's part of their soul is coming back to them. Or it could be a soul part from someone else that's coming up, that soul part from someone else's body that's in another body is bringing that up, feeling like it's deja vu. Those are a couple examples, and that singer, it's only limited to that, but those would be some examples of that being like such. So with that being said, everyone, we're going to go ahead and we're going to take a brief pause and come right back. So stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. Appreciate you all listening into this awesome content. Next, what we have here on the list is called demonology. I don't really need to go into it because we already did a list of demons from Ars Goetia. That's not to say those are the only demons based upon the Ars Goetia what's said, but demonology is just the study of demons. That's what that is. But the next one that here is on the list is Demiurge. This is a part of a series on theism. And, I don't recommend going down that path, but here's what Demiurge is meaning. In the Platonic Neo-Pythagorean, Middle Platonic, and Neoplatonic schools of philosophy, the Demiurge, sometimes spelled as without an E, so it's usually Demiurge, you can spell it without the E at the end, is an artisan-like figure responsible for fashioning and maintaining the physical universe. The Gnostics adopted the term Demiurge. Although a fashioner, the Demiurge is not necessarily the same as the creator figure in the monotheistic sense, because the Demiurge itself and the material form which the Demiurge fashions the universe are both considered consequences of something else. Depending on the system, they may be considered either uncreated and eternal, or the product of some other entity. The word Demiurge is an English word derived from Demiurgus, a Latinized form of the Greek, or Demiurgos. It was originally a common noun meaning craftsman or artisan, but gradually came to mean producer and eventually creator. The philosophical usage and the proper noun derive from Plato's Timaeus, written in 360 BC, where the Demiurge is presented as the creator of the universe. The Demiurge is also described as a creator in the Platonic and Middle Platonic philosophical traditions. In the various branches of the Neoplatonic school, 3rd century onwards, the Demiurge is the fashioner of the real perceptible world after the model of the ideas. But in most Neoplatonic systems, is still not itself the one. In the arch-dualist ideology of the various Gnostic systems, the material universe is evil, while the non-material world is good. According to some strains of Gnosticism, the Demiurge is malevolent, as it is linked to the material world. In others, including the teaching of Valentinus, the Demiurge is simply ignorant or misguided. So, as you can see, one of the things that's pushed around is saying, oh, the material world is evil. You hear that in a lot of religious teachings. And it's not. There's just a corruption that the enemy has placed in many things. However, while that's the abstract to what it's talking about, it goes into Platonism and Neoplatonism more in depth with the Demiurge, including henology, and iamblichus, something like that. And it talks about Gnosticism, angels, Yaldabaoth, types of names, Marcion, Valentinus, the devil, Cathars, not Khazars, but the Cathars. I also talk about Neoplatonism and Gnosticism in here that talks about Plotinus or Plotinus or whatever you want to call it. So it goes a little bit more in depth, but essentially this is just a false ideology that has been placed in many religions, including Christianity, for example, thinking that the material world is evil, the material universe is evil. That's a lie. But to go on to the next one, we have what's called discernment of spirits. So this one here is a term used in Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Charismatic, Christian theology. I don't know why people are associating Charismatic with evangelists, which are not the same thing. To judge the influence of various spiritual angels on an individual's morality. Spiritual agents. These agents are one from within the human soul itself, known as concupiscence. Sometimes I can't pronounce these words. Concupiscence, whatever. Considered evil. Number two, divine grace. Consider good. Angels considered good. Devils considered evil. Discernment of spirits is considered necessary to discern the cause of a given impulse, although some people are regarded as having a special gift to discern the causes of an impulse intuitively. Most people are held to require study and reflection, and possibly the direction of others in the discernment of spirits. Judgment of discernment can be made in two ways. The first is by a charism or spiritual gift held as divinely granted to certain individuals for the discerning of spirits by intuition, which how they're relating 1 Corinthians 12:10 does not make any sense, but okay. The second way to discern spirits is by reflection and theological study. I think they meant to put the third method, because they have the second way and then the second method, the second method is by acquired human knowledge. However, it is always gained with the assistance of grace by reading of the Holy Bible, of works on theology and asceticism, of autobiographies and the correspondence of the most distinguished ascetics. Yeah, I'm gonna tell y'all right now, that's a load of crap. While sure some of it is where those who are of the body of Yeshua, children of God, all can discern spirits. Some can discern spirits better than others. However, because of today, most of the church is lacking in understanding that just because someone has some sort of brokenness in them, that is a traumatized soul part that's suppressed by satanic ritual abuse or whatever the case may be, does not mean that is a demon. And sure, there is divine grace, but divine grace doesn't mean it's going to be specifically on only certain people. There are angels, but there are a multitude of types of angels. Besides angels, there's archangels, seraphim, cherubim. Okay. And then the other one talking about devils. They forgot to add in demon. Demons in there as well, because there's more than just devils and demons throughout the spiritual realm. More than just that. There is technology used by hybrid entities, meaning they're physical and can shapeshift into a squid. I don't know. But they look like they're a beautiful woman, but they're like this disgusting octopus, whatever the case may be, okay? But throughout here, it talks about orthodox views, as well as divine help and demonic help. It goes over, as well as discernment of night dreams, properties of true miracles, which I'm going to cover here right now. Cleopa Ely, I think that's how you pronounce him, is an abbot in the Romanian Orthodox Church. He wrote in his book on dreams and visions that true miracles must be worthy of the name of God and must be contained in the Holy Scriptures and Holy Tradition. What if some of those are not in the Bible, and they do come from God? What then? What if they're not a part of that same tradition? How can you say that they wouldn't be if they do come from God? Yeah, so I'm going to keep going, but be accomplished by the means by which the Savior and his saints performed miracles. That is a way, yes. Not deny each other and do not oppose one to the other. Yeah. Not contradict the scripture and secret tradition.
When tradition is contradictory to the truth, God is saying something else compared to what tradition says.
You bet you're going to say tradition contradicts the truth.
Have the salvation of the human soul as the goal.
I completely disagree with that, because that is not the entire goal. Sure, salvation of the human soul is a goal, but is not the goal. Provide benefit for and promote spiritual life, not death and sin.
Yes, that's true.
Now, this dude is also saying, the one who performs true miracles must, quote, tell only the truth, lead a blameless life, and not pursue personal interests and selfish goals. Okay, so if one who performs miracles, how would they always tell the truth, lead a blameless life, not pursue personal interests and selfish goals, but miracles are happening? What do you say about that? Exactly. You can't say that they tell only the truth, lead a blameless life, and not pursue personal interests and selfish goals, because that's a fallacy. Of course, telling the truth is a must, but no one today is leading a blameless life. There are things that we have done, that have happened, that we go through, and miracles happen while working out the things that we don't want in our life. But pursuing personal interests and selfish goals, understandable. But personal interests can align with what you're doing to have miracles happen. Correct the morals of those who see a miracle. Depends. Depends on the situation. Most of the time, yes. Give these people the confidence and power of the Spirit of God. Yes. Testify the work of God's providence.
Yeah.
Then, of course, they also talk about three renunciations, cases of right and wrong discernment. I also go into Ignatian view, Roman Catholic, as well as Pentecostal and Charismatic views. But I'm going to speak on this part, on cases of right and wrong discernment. When something demonic is accepted as divine, i.e., when there is an error in discernment of spirits, this may result in spiritual delusion, because the latter, by the definition of Ignatius, I do not know how to pronounce that name. I think it's Branchaninov, something like that, is man's assimilation of falsehood, which he accepts as truth. The degree of delusion is the degree of such assimilation. There are many stories in the lives of the saints when people were deceived by false visions of the demons in the form of Lord Jesus and angels. I'll say that again. There are many stories in the lives of the saints when people were deceived by false visions of the demons in the form of Lord Jesus and angels. And they're quoting 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14. So, yeah. You gotta discern if you're talking to Yeshua or not. Because if you ain't talking to Yeshua, you could be talking to a demon in a Jesus costume. You don't even have to be going through any kind of programming. For example, Niketas of Novgorod. In the early life, he was deluded by an angel, as if being sent to help him after he recklessly attempted to the feat of seclusion. Due to lack of humility and discernment, Niketas took this appearance for a true angel and obeyed him. The angel started to pray instead of Niketas and told him only to read books and give advice to people,
visiting him and not to pray. He started to prophesy for the visitors and became a known seer. Instead, the elders of the monastery had enough discernment to notice that in conversations, the recluse cited only the Old Testament and never the New Testament. So they understand that Niketas was in delusion. They cast the angel away, and gradually Niketas got healed, and gained humility, and later was made a bishop. Simeon the Stylite was deluded by demons, who showed him a chariot wanting to take him to heaven, as it was with Prophet Elias, probably mean Elijah. Due to lack of discernment, Simeon decided to enter the chariot, but before he made the sign of the cross, the chariot disappeared. So. Yeah. That might be where, could have been the wrong thing. Or maybe he did some wrong sign of the cross. But that's what it is sounding like. That, things were looking right, but then they became wrong because they were like, oh, we're out. But just because you make the sign of the cross does not mean the enemy is going to be disappearing. Doesn't work like that today. When Pachomius the Great was living in solitude, the devil appeared in front of him as Christ and said, "Greetings, Pachomius, whatever. I am Christ, paying you a visit, my faithful friend." But Pachomius was in turmoil and had confusing thoughts. Using discernment, he understood the delusion and rejected the vision. "Devil, depart from me. Cursed are you and your visions and your insidious arts. You have no place among the servants of God." It says there's more cases are described in the article about Prelest. So, I can't say that that Yeshua did appear to this individual or not, because it says, but Pachomius was in turmoil and had confusing thoughts. So it doesn't say that once he met this entity, if they say it's a demon or a devil. It just says, but Pachomius was in turmoil and had confusing thoughts. So it doesn't say he was in turmoil before that happened, or was in turmoil when this entity appeared. So we can't say that's actually the truth. Were you in turmoil and your thoughts were confusing before or during? Because if it was during, that would make sense. But if it was beforehand, well, that's a rejection of the truth. So, but you can go ahead and look at the rest. You can make your own decisions on that. That being said, the next one that's on the list, I believe it's pronounced Djembe, because I spell it with a D or without a D. But it's Djembe. It is a goblet-looking... It is a drum-looking goblet. It's a rope-turned, skin-covered goblet drum. Yes. I mean, if you use it in rituals for witchcraft and sorcery purposes, yeah, absolutely. You know, definitely witchcraft, sorcery tool, occult tool. But it just seems like it's a drum. That's it's a drum. Makes a sound. Makes a frequency. Just because there's a frequency doesn't mean it's evil. The next one that's on the list they actually have as devil. So in here, while There are a few names such as Satan, Lucifer, Beelzebub, Mephistopheles, Iblis, etc. All right. A devil can be a demon, but there's also people usually think of the devil as Satan, and will think of the name as Lucifer. But here's the strong but about this. He's not called Lucifer in Hebrew. He's never called Lucifer in the Hebrew language, nor in Arabic, nor in Greek, for that matter. It was only in Latin they put it as Lucifer. The actual name that's being referenced to in Isaiah and Ezekiel is Hillel ben. There's one of three ways of saying. You can either say it's Sakar, Shahar, or Shakar. I chose Sakar. Hillel ben Sakar. That was my choosing. But Sakar, Shahar, or Shakar. Those are one of the three pronunciations. That is the original name. But I also want to make something very clear about this as well. Hillel ben Sakar, that's mentioned in Isaiah and Ezekiel, is not the same fallen angel that was in the Garden of Eden. The reason why is because the angel, the fallen angel, that people know think is Lucifer, his name is Hillel ben Sakar, is a cherubim. Okay, cherubim looks like a man, has, if I'm not mistaken, six wings. It's either four or six wings, something like that. Whereas the fallen angel in the Garden of Eden is a seraphim. Seraphim are reptilian in nature. This is historical. You can find this in many old texts, whether in the Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, Greek, okay? You will find that seraphim are usually reptilian in nature. So the two fallen angels that are mentioned that people think are the same thing, are the same fallen angel, are not. Two separate fallen angels. Two completely separate. It's a matter of discerning that they are not the same. Hence of discernment of spirits. The next one that's here on the list, I actually didn't write it down on this list, but it's divination, okay? Predicting the future, prophesying, foretelling, so forth, using occult means and methods. We've talked a great deal already. We're going to cover more ways of types of divination, but divination in and of itself is using God's energy and manipulating it for your selfish purposes to get paid by someone who wants to see the future, that doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe God's helping them. But the next one that we have on the list, actually, I do have written down here, is called dowsing, all right? Dowsing is an attempt to locate groundwater. You can also do it for buried metals or ores, gemstones, oil, claimed radiations, grave sites, malign earth vibrations, etc. can also call it divining, such as water divining, doodle bugging, searching for petroleum, or water finding, such as water witching. I would not be surprised if the oil giants use doodle bugging, searching for their petroleum. But, you know, I don't think they really do that anymore because they control the vast majority of the oil that is always plentiful and keeps rejuvenating. There is no lack in oil. But it is not... it is not allowing God to work through you to find those elements. It's by using your mind to communicate through a device to find elements. Whereas instead you use your heart to communicate with your words for elements to materialize. So that's why dowsing is bad, because you're using it through your mind and not through your heart. Next one that is on the list, that's actually as the title, Dragon. Now, they say here it's a large, magical, legendary creature that appears in the folklore of multiple cultures worldwide. Beliefs about dragons vary considerably through regions, but dragons in Western cultures since the High Middle Ages have often been depicted as winged, horned, and capable of breathing fire. Dragons in Eastern cultures are usually depicted as wingless, four-legged, serpentine creatures with above-average intelligence. Commonalities between dragons' traits are often a hybridization of feline, reptilian, mammal, and avian features. Scholars believe vast extinct or migrating crocodiles bear the closest resemblance, especially when encountered in forested or swampy areas, and are most likely the template of modern Oriental dragon imagery. Well, there is a mighty long list that goes down here, talks about the dragon, such as myth origins. There's also African folklore that's talked about, Asian folklore, European folklore. You also have modern depictions that are mentioned as well. Like fire-breathing statue of the Ukrainian Iron Belly from Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 at Universal Studios, Florida. There's that one. You also have dragon that's in Dungeons and Dragons that's in there. But you also have in The Hobbit from J.R.R. Tolkien's book in there. One thing that I actually came across on social media would make sense, but got to back it up with more evidence on it. Put it that way. That a Tyrannosaurus Rex isn't a Tyrannosaurus Rex. It is actually the bones of a dragon and the wing bones removed. And one of the things that they were saying is that, I mean, think about it. What were the point of the stubby little arms? They couldn't do anything with stubby little arms. You couldn't really hold anything. I mean, it was like two fingers and a thumb on each hand, but they were very short. And then they positioned those on the wings, which would make more sense. So that's the thought of what, you know, dragons actually being around, and that they are in museums as what's called as the Tyrannosaurus Rex. That's a thought. Just got to do a little bit more digging on that one. Now, next one that is on the list for D is called Drac. You know, like from the Guardians of the Galaxy, but a little away from that. But the Drac. There's a few other variations of spelling, but in Oldenburg, also Drake, is a household spirit from German folklore often identified with the Kobold, or Kobold. Kobold, that's what it is. Or the devil. Both of which are also used as synonymous terms for Drac. Otherwise, it's also known as Draki, such as dragon, but has nothing much to do with the reptilian monster in general. There's quite a few names to it, but in appearance, what they are talking about is it's variable. Although humanoid shape is attested as mannequin, sometimes with a red cap and a red jacket, the Drac predominantly takes the shape of an animal, especially frequently mentioned in the appearance of a cat or kitten, but is black or brown black. Even a so-called, I don't know how to pronounce that word, but they mean devil cat, or a chicken, such as a cock or a hen, be it black or even wet. Such a Drachenhuhn, meaning a dragon chicken, is sometimes capable of laying thaler, or silver eggs. Thaler, large silver coins minted in the states and territories of the Holy Roman Empire. In the latter case, two per day. Two silver eggs per day. Other attested bird shapes, besides bird in general, are the partridge, the greyhawk, an owl, and a jackdaw. The Drac might also appear as a calf, a three-legged or fiery hare, a wingless red snake, even though snakes are wingless, or a black ant. The Drac might take the shape of an animal by day and that of a kobold by night, or it appears as a chicken inside the house and a fiery appearance outside of it. Various fiery appearances are also typical for the Drac when it flies out at night. A shooting star, meteor, will-o'-the-wisp, which we're going to talk about later, or lightning flash might thus very well be the Drac. The fiery appearance of the Drac, it too is variable to describe exhaustingly. Thus only a few examples shall suffice. It might appear as a fire column or fire pillar, as various objects with a fiery tail, such as a broom, glowing ball, star, as a fiery red lamp, a firelight, fiery grain sack, and quite frequently as a fiery broom. The broad head, a big head like a stovepot, or surrounded by blue firelight. Other appearances are more like animals, such as a fiery snake, cat, or chicken, a being with a big fiery head and a long black-blue tail, and a being with a big dog head and a glowing snake tail. Where the Drac is flying, everything burns down. Because of that, it is regarded as an omen of firestorm. The Drac might also burn down its owner's house if it feels mistreated. Names associated with the Drac's fiery-tailed appearance are Herbrand, such as Shooting Star, or Langschwanz, such as Long Tail, or Kurzschwanz, which is a short tail. Schillingstiert, it's another one, which is either a gobble tail or entwining tail. You have Glusschwanz, Glonstart, or Glustert, all meaning glowing tail, and Salamander. It further is accompanied by infernal sulfur stench. So, has a multitude of appearances that it could and couldn't be. But you can look at how they talk about owning a Drac, as well as driving the Drac away. So, if you find one, let me know. I want to get some silver eggs. But the next The last two that are on the list for letter D is dream interpretation. Now, dream interpretation itself isn't an evil occult method. It can be, based upon who you're speaking with. Who you're speaking with will determine whether it comes from God, comes from the wisdom of men, or comes from the kingdom of darkness. Pick your poison or pick your life. That's what I say. But the last one is going to be called a D-book, or D-book. In Jewish mythology, a D-book. I think that's how you pronounce it. D-bek. Yiddish, from the Hebrew verb dabak, meaning adhere or cling, is a malicious possessing spirit believed to be the dislocated soul of a dead individual. It supposedly leaves the host body once it has accomplished its goal, sometimes after being exorcised, you know, an exorcism. So this would just be another name for, yeah, a soul that could attach to someone else for certain purposes, because someone had the enemy give them legal access and continue to give them legal access for their soul to go on, latch onto another individual. But everyone, it has been great and been real. We're going to pause here because that is list D. And what we're going to cover is list E. So stay tuned. We're going to be right back. Cool. Welcome back, everybody. What we got going on here is the first one on the list for letter E is called Earth Mysteries. What I put down here is geographical locations or historical significance termed by New Age movements that have spiritual energy, / power, or natural causes. That's what I have down on the list here. But what it's talking about here is a wide range of spiritual, quasi-religious ideas focusing on cultural and religious beliefs about the Earth, generally with a regard for specific geographic locations of historic importance. Similar to modern Druidry, prehistoric monuments are of particular spiritual importance to believers in Earth mysteries, who consider certain locations to be sacred and/or containing active spiritual energies. The term alternative archaeology has also been used to describe the study of Earth mysteries beliefs. The study of ley lines originates in the 1920s with Alfred Watkins. Ley lines would be such as the lines that make up the actual grid of the Earth, not the matrix grid that the enemy created, but the actual grid of the energy that's a grid on the Earth. The term Earth Mysteries for this field of interest was coined about 1970 in the Lee Hunter Journal, and the associated concepts have been embraced and reinvented by movements such as the New Age movement and modern paganism during the 1970s to 1980s. Some New Age believers engage and travel to locations they consider important according to their beliefs. For example, Stonehenge is a popular destination amongst New Age seekers because there were a lot of ritual sacrifices, blood ritual sacrifices that were happening at Stonehenge that are not used today. It's not used for time. Those things that are in a circle, portals, as far as I'm aware. I could be wrong, though. That's just as far as I'm aware. But it does talk about history and reception based upon Earth mysteries. So this is a very deep subject, but Earth mysteries just means that there's a lot of spiritual energy, as well as energy of the Earth, that in these locations it could be something that the enemy corrupted over time and cursed and needs cleansing, or it's an area that hasn't been hurt by the enemy, and it's part of God's territory, or maybe it's just something that the enemy did a while ago that the enemy hasn't touched in a long time, or maybe it's something that's part of God's territory, people haven't not even the enemy has touched in a while, whatever it may be. The next one that is on the list that I don't have on the list here is actually called an Esbat. So an Esbat is a coven meeting or ritual at a time other than one of the Sabbats. Within Wicca and other Wiccan-influenced forms of contemporary paganism. So, covens have esbats. So it's a occult term for a meeting of witches and wizards and warlocks. Usually witches. Next one that is on the list here is actually called Ectenia. Ectenia, spelled with a C or a K, meaning diligence. Often called by the better known English word litany, consists of a series of petitions occurring in the Eastern Orthodox and Byzantine Catholic liturgies. In Greek, I can't say that word, but or I think it's pronounced synopti, is a prevalent ecclesiastical word for this kind of litany, while in Church Slavonic, romanized as Ectenia, is a preferred word. A litany is normally intoned by a deacon, with a choir or people chanting the responses. As he concludes each petition, the deacon raises the end of his orarion and crosses himself. If there is no deacon serving, the petitions are intoned by a priest. During many litanies, the priest says a prayer silently. After the last petition of the litany, the priest says an ekphonesis, something like that, which, when a silent prayer is said during the litany, is the final phrase of that prayer. When there is no priest present during the canonical hours, the litanies are not said. Rather, the reader replaces them by saying, "Lord, have mercy," 3, 12, or 40 times, depending on which litany is being replaced. But an overview talks about the Great Litany, Litany of Supplication, Litany of Fervent Supplication, Little Litany, Litany of the Catechumens, Litany of the Faithful, as well as Special Litanies. And we will cover liturgy when we get to L. But Ectenia is a part of a series on the Eastern Orthodox Church. Does not have any occult ties, as far as I'm aware. It's just a form of really a ritual part of the Eastern Orthodox way of doing things. Ritual doesn't always mean someone being put on a slab and their throat slit, okay? That's not what ritual is always meaning, even though a lot of people are starting to think that today. But next one that is on the list is actually called ectoplasm. And what I actually told y'all back here, ectoplasm, substance of spiritual energy manifested by physical mediums. That's usually what it is, and that can be with white or black magic. However, what is a term used in spiritualism to denote a substance of spiritual energy exteriorized by physical mediums? It was coined in 1894 by a physical researcher, Charles Richet. Although the term is widespread in popular culture, there's no scientific evidence that ectoplasm exists, and many purported examples were exposed as hoaxes fashioned from cheesecloth, gauze, or other natural substances. What I will say is ectoplasm is a real thing, because while there is a phenomenon, satanic forces. It does talk about fraud in here. That ectoplasm essentially would be like your DNA and mRNA that comes from the spirit realm. That's essentially what it would be like. I can't really say it other than that. But to bring ectoplasm here into our realm, I wouldn't recommend doing that. Just put it that way. Oh, and here's one of my other favorite things I wanted to cover. I believe his... I don't think his name is in here. Might be. Yeah, I don't think his name is in here. That's okay. If I come across it, I'll come across it. Guy Dave that I came across on Twitter when I was going through this. But the next one is, it's because this next section that we're going over is called the 8th Circuit Model of Consciousness. All right, I told you all about this in here where it's drug experiences linking two chakras in Kabbalah. It's a prominent model in chaos magic. All right, this is why they want to get people into raves, why they want to get people into these, I don't know what you call them, but you go to these farms that have the drugs that they grow, and then you go and do it yourself for any kind of campfire stuff where you're doing drugs to get into a mode with each other. But anyway, they say here, it's a holistic model originally presented as psychological philosophy, abbreviated sci-fi, instead of a F-I, it's a P-H, by Timothy Leary in books including Neurologic and Exopsychology, later expanded on by Robert Anton Wilson in his books Cosmic Trigger and Prometheus Rising, and by Antero Ali in his books Angel Tech, 1985, and The 8th Circuit Brain, 2009, that suggests 8 periods, circuits, within the model. This model has been described as a potential route towards reconciling different interpretations of what it means to be a human being. The 8 circuits, or 8 systems, or brains, as referred by other authors, operate within the human nervous system. Each corresponds to its own imprint and subjective experience of reality. Leary and Ali include 3 stages for each circuit, detailing development points for each level of consciousness. The model lacks scientific credibility and has largely been ignored in academia. An overview of this is of the 8 circuits in this model of consciousness. The first 4 circuits concern themselves with life on Earth and the survival of the human species. The last 4 circuits are post-terrestrial and concern themselves with the evolution of the human species as represented by so-called altered states of consciousness, enlightenment, mystical experiences, psychedelic states of mind, and psychic abilities. The proposal suggests that these altered states of consciousness are recently realized, but not widely utilized. Leary describes the first 4 as larval circuits, necessary for surviving and functioning in a terrestrial human society. Proposed that the most terrestrial circuits will be useful for future humans who, through a predetermined script, continue to act on their urge to migrate to outer space and live extraterrestrially. Leary, Wilson, and Ali have written about the idea in depth and have explored and attempted to define how each circuit operates, both in the lives of individual people and in societies and civilizations. The term circuit is equated to a metaphor of the brain being computer hardware and the wiring of the brain as circuitry. Leary used the 8 circuits along with recapitulation theory to explain the evolution of the human species.
the personal development of an individual, and the biological evolution of all life. But the eight-circuit conscious model is based on the eight consciousnesses, which is actually part of Buddhism. So that's why you don't want to be doing that stuff. But again, chaos magic is heavily involved in it. Doesn't really say it, but because the one individual that came up, Dave, is part of chaos magic. And is part of the connected with those people that are doing the eighth circuit conscious model. Next one we have here on the list is called Ein Sof. It's actually part of Kabbalah. It's spelled E-I-N-S-O-F or E-Y-N-S-O-F. It's meaning infinite, no end. It's in Kabbalah understood as God prior to any self-manifestation in the production of any spiritual realm, probably derived from Solomon Ibn Gabirol's term, the Endless One. So again, I suggest watching Exposing Kabbalah so you can learn more about that. The next one that we do here have on the list is called Elemental. Alright, so Elemental, in the occult, it's being made through alchemy, or it can be held in bondage to be used against us. But in Elemental, spoken of here, is a mythic supernatural being that is described in occult and alchemical works from around the time of the European Renaissance, and particularly elaborated in the 16th century works of Paracelsus. According to Paracelsus and his subsequent followers, there are four categories of elementals, which are gnomes, undines, sylphs, and salamanders. These correspond to the four empedocline elements of antiquity. Forgive me for butchering that. But they are earth, air, water, and fire, respectively. Terms employed for beings associated with alchemical elements vary by source and gloss. So it does talk about the history into this as well. As well as Paracelsus talks about its gnome being of earth, undine being of water, sylph being of air, salamander being of fire. And of course, there's other authors and beliefs that go into this. There's a comparison with Jainism, which I'll go here, because they also talk about 12th century and art and entertainment. But in Jainism, there is a superficially similar concept within its general cosmology. Can't pronounce their language on it, but means one sensed beings with bodies that are composed of a single element, albeit with a five element system: earth, water, air, fire, and plant. But these beings are actual physical objects and phenomena, such as rocks, rain, fires, and so on, which are endowed with souls. In the Paracelsian concept, elements are conceived more as supernatural humanoid beings, which are much like human beings except for lacking souls. This is quite the opposite from the Jain conception, which rather than positing soulless elementals, is positing that physical objects have some type of soul, and that what are commonly considered inanimate objects have this particular type of soul. 12th century says, in contemporary times, there are those who study and practice rituals to invoke elementals. These include Wiccans and followers of nature-based religions. So yes, it is a sentient being in the spirit that is behind the actual element itself here in our physical realm. That's what an elemental is. And there is actually a new movie called Elementals. Disney is bringing out on Disney+. But the next one that we have here on the list that actually is talked about is called energy.
or esotericism. Here it just says, proponents and practitioners of various esoteric forms of spirituality and alternative medicine refer to a variety of claimed experiences and phenomena as being due to energy or force that defy measurement and thus are distinguished from the scientific form of energy. Claims related to energy therapies are most often anecdotal, rather than being based on repeatable empirical evidence. There's no scientific evidence for the existence of such energy. In physics, educators criticize the use of the term energy to describe ideas in esotericism and spirituality as potentially confusing. But energy is true, because energy, while it's not esoteric, it's not New Age, it is part of the things that are of the unseen realm, the spirit realm. That's what this energy is referring to. The next one on the list here is actually called English Kabbalah with a Q. You can spell with a C, a Q, or a K. And you can actually could spell it this way, they spell it Q-A-B-A-L-L-A, or you could spell it with a C instead, or you could spell Kabbalah as K-A-B-B-A-L-A-H. It's another way it can be spelled. But either way, Kabbalah is Kabbalah, or you can spell Kabbalah Q-A-B-A-L-A-H. It's another way. But either way, it's all same a part of that nonsense. Now, what isn't spoken of that we will go over is Enochian. So for everyone here, Enochian was created by John Dee and Edward Kelly between 1583 to 1584. For those of you who do not know who John Dee is, I'll pull him up here. He was known for being the advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. Yes, that's where I had to find it. I'm trying to remember. So, as you can see, why the satanic bloodlines dealt with the royal families is one of those ways. And so, John Dee, one of the ways that he signed off to Queen Elizabeth I was 007. Hence where 007 comes from. Yes, there are 00 statuses in MI6. Yes, the 00 agents are super soldiers, and they protect the Committee of 300. But we're going over John Dee and Enochian. But Enochian is an occult-constructed language said by its originators to have been received from angels, quote-unquote, recorded in the private journals of John Dee and his colleague Edward Kelly in the late 16th century England. Kelly was a scryer who worked with Dee in his magical investigations. The language is integral to the practice of Enochian magic. The language found in Dee's and Kelly's journals encompasses a limited textual corpus. Linguist Donald Laycock, an Australian skeptic, studied the Enochian journals and argues against any extraordinary features. The untranslated texts of the Liber Logaeth manuscript recall the patterns of glossolalia rather than true language. Dee did not distinguish the Liber Logaeth material from the translated language of the Khals, which is more like an artificial language. This language was called angelical by Dee. and later came to be referred to as Enochian by subsequent writers. The phonology and grammar resemble English, though the translations are not sufficient to work out any regular morphology. Some Enochian words resemble words and proper names in the Bible, but most have no apparent etymology. Dee's journals also refer to this language as celestial speech, first language of God Christ, holy language, or language of angels. He also referred to it as Adamic language. Because according to Dee's angels, it was used by Adam in paradise to name all things. The term Enochian comes from Dee's assertion that the biblical patriarch Enoch had been the last human before Dee and Kelly to know the language. And this is actually a complete lie, because this is the counterfeit version of speaking in tongues. The counterfeit version of heavenly language. So if you want to do a little bit more research on that, you can, because it does talk about seeking contact and reported visions, receiving the angelic keys, phonology and writing system, talks about the grammar with morphology, compounds, conjugation, pronouns, syntax, vocabulary and corpus of dictionaries, representation of numbers, relation to other languages, and so forth. The next one that we have here is actually called Ephemeris. Ephemeris. In astronomy and celestial navigation, in Ephemeris, meaning diary or journal, is a book with tables that gives the trajectory of naturally occurring astronomical objects, as well as artificial satellites in the sky, i.e. the position, and possibly velocity over time. Historically, positions were given as printed tables of values, given at regular intervals of date and time. The calculation of these tables was one of the first applications of mechanical computers. Modern ephemerides, I think that's how you pronounce it, are often provided in electronic form. However printed, ephemerides are still produced, as they are useful when computational devices are not available. The astronomical position calculated from an ephemeris is often given the spherical polar coordinate system of right ascension and declination, together with the distance from the origin, if applicable. Some of the astronomical phenomena of interest to astronomers are eclipses, apparent retrograde, motion/planetary stations, planetary ingresses, sidereal time, positions for the mean and true nodes of the moon, phases of the moon, and the positions of minor celestial bodies such as Chiron. are used in celestial navigation and astronomy. They are also used by astrologers. GPS signals include ephemeris data used to calculate the position of satellites in orbit. And there is a history, quite a long history. Guess where it dates back originally from? Babylon. So, as you can see, something not to take part of. Now, it's not to say that you can't use calculations of the patterns of the celestial bodies, such as the moon, the sun, stars, planets, and so forth. It's not to say that. It's just to say that you don't want to be using this. Because pretty much going into astrology, put it that way. Now, the next one that we have here that's also on the list, we might go into it. It's called ESP, extrasensory perception. There's not really much to talk about for this, other than the fact it's psychometry, telekinesis, telepathy. That's what it is, you know, psychic powers. That's what it's referring to. But the next one that's on the list is esoteric Christianity. Now, esoteric Christianity is essentially taking in the New Age and merging it in with biblical teaching, such as, for example, using the Talmud, Mishnah, Gevorah, as well as using Kabbalah, Thelema, etc. to think of things that are not from God, that are mixing truth with lies. That's what esoteric Christianity is. But the next one that's here, they call, while esoteric cosmology, it goes into religious cosmology. And it's something that we already covered, because there's the New Age way of looking at stuff. Down into the list, you have Western esotericism, also known as esotericism, and sometimes referred to as Western mystery tradition. But the picture is actually has the Kabbalistic tree of life containing the Sephiroth, the guy sitting on a bench holding the bottom side of it. Because esotericism, while there's things that are spoken of, a lot of things that they do are counterfeit to doing things of original creation. Down the list we have entheogen. Entheogen are psychoactive substances that induce alterations in perception, mood, consciousness, cognition, or behavior for the purposes of engendering spiritual development or otherwise in sacred context. The anthropological study has established that entheogens are used for religious, magical, shamanic, or spiritual purposes in many parts of the world. Entheogens have traditionally been used to supplement many diverse practices geared towards achieving transcendence, including divination, meditation, yoga, sensory deprivation, healings, asceticism, prayer, trance, rituals, chanting, imitation of sounds, hymns like peyote songs, drumming, and ecstatic dance. The psychedelic experience is often compared to non-ordinary forms of consciousness such as those experienced in meditation, near-death experiences, and mystical experiences. Ego dissolution is often described as a key feature of the psychedelic experience. So, it is a drug. Tripping out on stuff that leads you into dimensions that you shouldn't be going into because you have no authority there and you're allowing the enemy legal access to move through you because you are not controlling your body and your experiences. So the next one that is on the list is the evil eye. A supernatural belief in a curse brought about by a malevolent glare, usually given to an individual when one is unaware. The evil eye dates back about 5,000 years. In the 6th century BC, it appeared on Chalcidian drinking vessels, known as eye cups, as a type of protective magic. It's found in many cultures in the Mediterranean region as well as Western Asia and Central Asia, with such cultures often believing that receiving the evil eye will cause misfortune or injury, while others believe it to be a kind of supernatural force that casts
or reflects a malevolent gaze back upon those who wish harm upon others, especially innocents. Older iterations of the symbol were often made of ceramic or clay. However, following the production of glass beads in the Mediterranean region in approximately 1500 BC, evil eye beads were popularized with the Phoenicians, Persians, Greeks, Romans, and Ottomans. The idea expressed by the term causes many different cultures to pursue protective measures against it, with around 40% of the world's population believing in the evil eye. The concept and its significance vary widely among different cultures, but it is especially prominent in the Balkans, Mediterranean, and West Africa. The idea appears multiple times in Jewish rabbinic literature. Other popular amulets and talismans used to ward off the evil eye include the Hamsa, while Italy, especially southern Italy, employs a variety of other unique charms and gestures to defend against the evil eye, including the Cornicello, or Cornicello, the Cimarota, and the sign of the horns. While the Egyptian Eye of Horus is a similar symbol of protection and good health and luck, you keep telling people that lie. The Greek evil eye talisman specifically protects against malevolent gazes. Similarly, the eye idols excavated at the Tel Brak Eye Temple are believed to have been figurines offered to the gods, and according to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, are unrelated to a belief in the evil eye. So they do go more into the history and around the world, and protective talismans and cures and media and press coverage and names in various languages about the evil eye. When I grew up with someone giving me the evil eye. Just says, like, they didn't like what you were doing. That thing. More of like a childish thing, but be that as it may, evil eye could also represent, based upon the light or lack of light thereof, the darkness protruding through the evil eye that wants to go through your eye. It's another one. We have three more, because the other one is called exoteric, refers to knowledge that is outside and independent from an individual's experience and can be ascertained by anyone. Okay, I'm not going to go over that, but is evocation, act of calling upon or summoning a spirit, demon, deity, or other supernatural entity. So, this one can have a lot of relation towards white and black magic and necromancy. Again. But while it is a conjuration, refers to a summoning, often by the use of a magical spell, the conjuration of the ghosts or spirits of the dead for the purpose of divination is called necromancy. Comparable practices exist in many religions and magical traditions and may employ the use of mind-altering substances with and without uttered word formulas, which would be like the mind-to-mind communication stuff. Now, when you evoke something, you can do that with your spirit, because we have a separate spirit, separate soul, separate body. Our spirit is not our soul, and our soul is not our spirit. Our spirit is hid in Yeshua, while our soul is inside of our body. You can evoke things from the spirit realm that your spirit brings in here. You can evoke God to bring something in here. That's how you can use that. Or you can evoke evil, malevolent entities that portray themselves like they're benevolent, but are not. So the
second last one on here that I actually went over a little bit before on banishment is exorcism. Exorcism here, it says, is a religious or spiritual practice of evicting demons, jinns, or other malevolent spiritual entities from an individual or an area that is believed to be possessed. Depending on the spiritual beliefs of the exorcist, this may be done by causing the entity to swear an oath, performing an elaborate ritual, or simply by commanding it to depart in the name of a higher power. The practice is ancient and part of the belief system of many cultures and religions. Excuse me. So, yes, it does talk about how it's used in Christianity, as well as Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, Lutheran churches, Mormonism. It's even talked about. Criticism is also talked about of what's happened. But they also have Buddhism that's spoken of. Hinduism goes into it, Islam even, and Judaism, and Sikhism. Sikhism just says Sikhs do not have belief in demonic possession, therefore exorcism is considered a violation of Sikh code of conduct. So if you have the belief system of Sikhism or Sikhism, you might be walking with some demons in you. I'm not saying that's true, but if you're practicing that religion, it's a strong possibility. There's also Taoism and Chinese folk religion that talk about it. Scientific view, exorcism and mental illness, talks about in the United Kingdom as well. But apparently, in the UK, the numbers of exorcisms performed were increasing as of 2017. A Church of England think tank, Theos, stated that the exorcisms mostly took place in charismatic and Pentecostal churches, and also among communities of West African origin. Frequently, the people exorcised were people with mental health problems, who often stopped taking their medications in response to the exorcism. The report described the exorcism as a well-meaning initiative with potential for serious harm, with the risk of constituting psychological abuse. There's also anthropological views in here and notable exorcisms and exorcists in history. And while it does have some others in here, one movie that was done is called The Pope's Exorcist. That is, it's not completely based on a true story. It is using the life of an exorcist who's not in this list. But they do reveal how the Spanish Inquisition was actually led to massacre thousands of people in the name of God, which I believe to be true, even though the internet says, like, oh no, there were only a few hundred people that were killed. It wasn't thousands to hundreds of thousands. Yeah, okay. Okay. But here's one I want to say that's a bunch of nonsense. Mother Teresa allegedly underwent an exorcism late in life under the direction of the Archbishop of Calcutta, Henry de Souza, after he noticed she seemed to be extremely agitated in her sleep and feared she might be under attack of the evil one. But she was actually part of trafficking children. So, yeah. BS. However, be that as it may, exorcism is a form of banishment, which is witchcraft. While true, you can cast out demons in the name of Yeshua. Exorcisms, the way that they are done, are banishment. And last but not least, here on the list, is called the Eucharist. It's one of the things of the Catholic Church that's thought of in its use. But the Eucharist meaning Thanksgiving, also known as Holy Communion, Blessed Sacraments, and the Lord's Supper, is a Catholic rite. It says Christian rite, but I'm saying Catholic because it ain't Christian. It's Catholic. That is considered a sacrament in most churches, and as an ordinance in others. Christians believe that the rite was instituted by Jesus at the Last Supper, the night before his crucifixion, giving his disciples bread and wine. Passages in the New Testament state that he commanded them to do this in memory of me, while referring to this, the bread as my body, and the cup of wine as the blood of my covenant, which is poured out for many. According to this Synoptic Gospels, this was at a Passover meal. Sure, you can call it communion. I would not call it Eucharist, because it's a Catholic term. However, moving on, the elements of the Eucharist, sacramental bread, either leavened or unleavened, and wine, or non-alcoholic grape juice, in some Protestant traditions, are consecrated on an altar, or a communion table, and consumed thereafter. The consecrated elements are the end products of the Eucharistic prayer. Christians generally recognize the special presence of Yeshua in this rite, though they differ about exactly how, where, and when Christ is present. He is in all of us. End of story. The Catholic Church states that the Eucharist is the body of and blood of Christ under the species of bread and wine. It maintains that by the consecration, the substances of the bread and wine actually become the substance of the body and blood of Yeshua HaMashiach. Transubstantiation. While the appearance or accidents, quote, of the bread and wine remain unaltered, e.g. color, taste, feel, and smell. The Eastern Orthodox and Oriental Orthodox churches agree that an objective change occurs of the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. Lutherans believe that the true body and blood of Christ are really present in, with, and under the forms of the bread and wine, known as the sacramental union. Reformed Christians believe in a real spiritual presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Anglican Eucharists, or Eucharistic theologies, universally affirm the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Though evangelical Anglicans believe that this is a spiritual presence, while Anglo-Catholics hold to a corporeal presence. As a result of these different understandings, the Eucharist has been a central issue in the discussions and deliberations of the ecumenical movement. Now, Eucharist is something that is Catholic in its foundation. Communion is Protestant in its origin. Now, can this be used for evil purposes? Sure. Have I come across it personally? No. But it doesn't mean that it can't be used for evil purposes. And for that area. But in one section, such as Jews and the Eucharist, the concept of the Jews both destroying and partaking in some perverted version of the Eucharist has been a vessel to promote anti-Judaism and anti-Jewish ideology and violence. In medieval times, Jews were often depicted stabbing or in some other way physically harming communion wafers. These characterizations drew parallels to the idea that the Jews killed Christ. Murdering the transubstantiation or host was thought of as a repetition of the event. Jewish people's eagerness to destroy hosts were also a variation of blood libel charges. With Jews being accused of murdering bodies of Christ, whether they be communion wafers or Christian children, the blood libel charges in the concept of Eucharist are also related in the belief that blood is efficacious, meaning it has some sort of divine power,
which it does.
Yeah. So, and we did skip B, but when you click on blood libel, it says it's a part of a series on anti-Semitism. But a blood libel is a, or a ritual murder libel, is a, they say, anti-Semitic canard, which falsely accuses Jews of murdering Christian boys in order to use their blood in the performance of religious rituals. There's more that talks about it. But yes, blood libel is a part of Holocausts. Sacrifices. But getting back here into Eucharist, it does have a theology on it. Ritual liturgy goes into its non-observing denominations, practice and customs, and so forth. Or you can have open and closed communion in there, preparation for Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Protestant confessions, adoration. There's health issues like gluten, alcohol, transmission of diseases. You know, if you have a cold, don't drink out of the same cup. That kind of thing. But that is the end of list E that we have covered, because we covered D and E. Now we're going to go over F, but we're going to go on that to the next episode. Appreciate you all listening to this awesome content. Feel free to donate to help support this. But if not, the best way that you can help support this podcast is by sharing it with others. So until next time, peace, everyone.